Chapter 15. We arrived at the airstrip in time. I parked the cycle and raced to the ship with the kid in my arms, searching for Brandon, pushing past a group of Kibarakians and the LDF guard who were chaotically arranging a perimeter around the airstrip. The Mogadorians would be here soon. These Lorik would be the only thing protecting the ship as it took off. Like me, they would remain behind. We were going to die. There was no way around it. But with a little luck, the 9 children and their mentors would live, and with them, the Lorian people would survive. The 8 mentor Sepans stood outside the ship, waiting to go, while 8 young children, ranging in age from infancy to 6 years old, were arrayed in a circle on the ground. Another man was leaning over each of the children, touching their heads. It was the elder Loridas. It looked like he was blessing them or something. Well, if I was going to die, at least I could say I finally saw one of the elders. When Brandon saw me approach, a look of disgust began to creep into his face. Until he saw the boy. "This is the 9th," I said. I knew they'd be leaving any minute, and anxious to make my case. The words tumbled out in a rush. "It's not too late. You have to..."
"Quiet," said Brandon, taking the child.
He rushed over to Loridas, who had just finished whatever he was doing with the children. I nervously watched them confer, wondering how Loridas had made it to the planet.
"He's the last."
I turned to see a woman with long dark hair in her early 30s. She had read my look of confusion.
"The other elders are gone. They sacrificed themselves for us."
"Pittacus too?" I asked, stunned. I had never really thought much about Pittacus lore. Never reacted to his name with the unreserved awe that so many other Lorik had for him. But it was still a shock. Even with everything that had happened tonight, it had never occurred to me that he could be gone. It was almost unimaginable. An uncertain frown crept across the woman's face.
"Pittacus is missing," she said. "He may still be alive. We don't know."
I didn't respond. What was there to say?
"You look awfully young to be a mentor Sepan," she said.
"I'm just a trainee," I said, my eyes locked on Brandon, Loridas, and the boy. "Engineering, not a mentor."
"Could have fooled me,"
she said, glancing over at the boy. Loridas took him by the hand and laid him down in the sole remaining part of the circle. The other children all looked on as Loridas began to perform some kind of ritual. "Why are they all so young?" I asked the woman. "They're too young to have been trainees at the academy."
"These children were identified by the elders as the most powerful of their generation," she told me.
She sounded wistful as she said it.
"They have a long road ahead of them. They will have to learn to adapt to a new home and a new way of life that's unlike anything we know here. It will be better if they have as little memory of Lorien as possible. It will be easier for them."
I nodded sadly and turned back to watch the ritual. I was eager to take the whole sight in, but Brandon pulled me out to the edge of the airstrip.
"He has been admitted. The 8 is now 9, he said. "Funny thing is, Elder Loridas wasn't fazed at all. When I said the 9th had arrived, he turned to me and looked at me as if he'd known he was coming all along." I turned back to the collected mentor Sepans, to the guard arrayed on the ground, to the ship that would take them off this planet. I feared what my own fate would be, but was determined not to let Brandon see my fear.
I wanted to make a gracious and noble exit.
Go, I said. I'll join the perimeter guard. The suns were just starting to come up, the dusk colored by the flame and smoke of the planet's destruction.
Good luck up there, I said.
Stop, said Brandon. I turned back. You're coming with us.
Me? There's not room. I felt my heart rise in my chest. But I couldn't go along. What about the rest of the people here? The ones who have been fighting all along? The ones who actually believed?
The boy needs a mentor. You brought him here. He trusts you. And the bond has taken place. I can sense it. It has to be you.
But I haven't been trained.
The only thing any of us really need to know is to always put our guard's survival ahead of our own.
Brandon cast a glance back at the boy.
And it looks like you've got that part down.
Another explosion rumbled about a mile off, bringing our gaze across the sky to the approach of a massive Mogadorian ship. What looked like little wisps were parachuting out of the ship and landing gently, soundlessly on the ground. But of course, that was a trick of distance and perspective. They weren't wisps. They were Mogadorian ground troops. And there was nothing gentle about them. My fate had been decided. We rushed to the rest of the group to board the ship and leave our beloved Lorien before it was too late. Chapter 16.
Oof.
Barely awake, I was already in agony. The boy had just stepped hard on my legs and was now jumping up the rest of my body, crushing my stomach, then my ribs. Wake up, he said, still jumping painfully all over me. It was a hell of a way to wake up in the morning, but I was starting to get used to it. Wake up, repeated the boy, who we had all started to call Nine. He was bright-eyed, playful, and so full of energy that 5 minutes in his company was enough to make me pray for his bedtime. Nine and the other young guard had made a quick recovery from the horrors of that awful night, barely a month ago, when Lorien had fallen to the Mogadorians. The other mentor Sapons couldn't believe the children's resilience. We envied it. None of us would ever get over what we'd seen. I'm getting up, I said, swinging my legs over the bed and swiping my Kalvaka t-shirt off the hook on the wall. All of the other mentor Sapons were stuck with their LDA tunics, but I had only my street clothes from my last night out in Lorien. You're too slow, said Nine, yanking my arm as I tried to finish dressing. Sorry, buddy, I said. Had a late one last night.
What else is new?
I looked up to see Brandon, smiling at the edge of the partition separating my sleeping quarters from the rest of the ship. Brandon was always getting on my case for being a late riser, for always being the last Sapon socializing into the wee hours in the ship's canteen. If Brandon had gone to bed, there was always Kentra, or one of the others.
Today's the first day of pre-combat training, he said. I'll take Nine, it's not a problem.
Pre-combat? Already? I had a hard time understanding that they were already going to start conditioning some of the guard as warriors. Brandon and Kentra had explained it was just simple calisthenics and drills at this point. But still, the kids were so young. I saw Four, Brandon's guard, poking his head out from behind Brandon's back. He shyly put his hand out for Nine to take, inviting him to walk to pre-combat together. Seeing this, I hoped Nine would take Four's hand. It was a sweet gesture. Prokabat, rawr, squealed Nine, and jumped back onto the bed, either unaware of Four's overture or too keyed up to notice. I smiled, simultaneously exhausted by and proud of my guard's hyperactivity. I scooped Nine off the bed and put him on the floor. You go off with Brandon and Four, okay? I'll see you at one-on-ones after. One-on-ones were training and development sessions between Mentor Sepans and their guard. It had been decided that my one-on-ones with Nine would be overseen by another Mentor Sepan, owing to my inexperience and lack of training. But even with Brandon or Kentra breathing down my neck, one-on-ones were my favorite time of the day, just me and the kid. The large ship had an open plan with no walls, but in the interest of our privacy and sanity, programmable holographic partitions separated areas of the cabin into rooms. The canteen was one such space, located close to the ship's cockpit. It was nearly empty when I finally got there, and the food options were slim. A packet of freeze-dried caro fruit, a plate of mushy, lukewarm flora grain. Ah, I thought, the perils of oversleeping. I settled for the caro and took a seat next to Hesu, the only Sepan there. Hesu was the oldest of the Sepans, and shy to boot. I never knew what to say to her, so I just nodded at her and ate my breakfast in silence. As tended to happen when I had a moment to myself, my thoughts drifted to the events back on Lorien, both the things I had witnessed, the destruction of the capital, those heartbreakingly muddy tears on Nine's grandfather's cheeks, and those I had only imagined, my parents' chalet in Dalun blasted by Moog missiles, Devectra finally succumbing to the Mogadorian ground troops while valiantly defending her beloved city. I also thought back to the ship's takeoff, watching out the window as we pulled up and over the airstrip, the elder Loridus, who had insisted not to be taken on board, faded to a dot on the ground as we breached the planet's atmosphere, with the fighting Lorien defense forces and Kabarakian still down there, holding off the advancing Moog horde. The first few days in space had been the worst. We Mentor Sepans had all huddled in the canteen together, our impatient, traumatized charges in our laps, waiting for word from the ship's pilot about the fate of Lorien. Brandon had explained that the vast majority of the Council, the Academy, and the LDF had been killed in the first wave. But there were bound to be survivors, heroes like Devectra, who would fight off the invading forces no matter how bad the odds. It had been decided by a vote that once we had reached a distance of relative safety, the ship would hang back, watch, and wait. If there were any sign that the defeat of Lorien was incomplete, that whatever resistance movement had formed stood even a meager chance of survival, we would turn back and aid however we could. But after many sleepless days and nights, the pilot emerged into the canteen from the front of the ship and shook his head. "From the ship's scans," he said, fighting back tears. "There's nothing. Nothing's left." For every horror I had endured, that was the worst, the most devastating. Slowly but surely, things improved. And as dark as my thoughts got, it was hard to stay down when we had nine rambunctious, energetic kids all around us, every second of the day. "She's sick," announced Hesu. I almost did a double take. Hesu never spoke without first being spoken to. It took me a second to realize she must be talking about her guard, the girl we called One. "I woke up in the middle of the night with a bad feeling, so I went to the children's quarters to check. And sure enough, when I touched her forehead, it was hot. A bad fever." Hesu's aversion to eye contact was just part of her personality, but the intense way she avoided my look made me fear the worst. "Where is she?" I asked. "Is she okay?"
She's in the auto dock.
Because no one on board had any medical knowledge, the ship had been outfitted with a small, climate-controlled area called an auto dock. It monitored a patient's vital signs and administered medicine as needed through the air vents.
Machine says she'll be fine.
Well then, I said, relieved. That's good. Hesu merely shrugged. Her mouth was pursed, bitter-looking, like she'd been sucking on something sour.
She's going to die, she said.
I froze in my seat, speechless. It felt like Hesu's words had sucked all of the oxygen out of the room.
She will die. I'm certain of it.
Hesu, I'm sure she'll be fine. She turned at me, a look of rage and contempt burning on her face.
I don't mean now, you idiot.
She began to laugh bitterly.
Don't you realize? We're all going to die.
My blood turned to ice.
What was this woman getting at? Right, right, she said. You haven't been fully briefed yet. How would you know? This is a suicide mission. We are going to some distant planet to hide from the Mogadorians, to run from them, to make whatever pathetic efforts to survive we can make before they hunt us down and kill us. It's useless. I don't know why we're even bothering.
Her words seeped into my brain like a poison. But I tried to focus on the matter at hand, her hysteria. You need to calm down, I said.
Easy for you to say. You're last. You and your boy get blessed last out of sheer luck, because you were running late.
The bitter laughter came back.
While me and my girl, we're first. First blessed. First to die.
The laughter gave way to tears, and Hesu threw her face into her hands. I fought through my own horror and embraced her. We stayed like that for a while. I rocked her in my arms while the terrifying truth of our situation bled into my heart. Later, I made my way down the virtual corridor towards the empty barrack in which my one-on-ones with Nine were held. I felt like a fool for allowing myself to be optimistic about the Elder's plan for us all, for believing that the road ahead would be any brighter than the one behind us. To hear it from Hesu, it was only going to get grimmer once we reached our destination. And I felt like a fool for not inquiring deeper into the nature of the ritual Loridas had performed on Nine. I had foolishly assumed it was just some meaningless pagan blessing. But according to Hesu, it was much more than that. It was a protective spell that granted total immunity to the children. All except one. Her blessing was just a link to the others. She was not invulnerable. Once she died, two would be vulnerable. Once two died, three would be vulnerable. On and on up the chain of their precious young guard. Put in those terms, it no longer felt like any kind of blessing at all. It felt like a curse. And it made me sick just thinking about it. I paused outside the barracks door and looked out the window of the ship. All I could see were stars. We still had many galaxies to travel before we reached our destination. We were heading to Earth, a planet that was far from perfect. It was nothing like Lorien had been. But even with all the terrible stories I'd heard about Earth's misery, about the war, the famine, the pollution, I was looking forward to it, at least a little bit. I still remembered that transmission I'd watched on the night of Quartermoon, before I'd made the fateful decision to take Daxon's band and leave the Academy. And I knew that Earth couldn't possibly be all bad.
I entered the barrack to find Nine waiting on the floor, his back to the virtual door. Adele, Seven's mentor Sepan, sat in a chair in the corner, having been assigned supervisor duty for the day. "Hey, Adele," I said, giving her a smile and a little wave. Adele waved back. At the sound of my voice, Nine jumped up, whirled around, and raced right at me, grabbing me by the knees. Nine looked up at me, his eyes gleaming. "Sandor?" he asked, drawing my name out and wagging his head back and forth. "Are we going to play today?" I looked down at him and smiled. "Yeah, buddy," I said. "We're gonna play."
The Forgotten Ones. Chapter 1. My eyes fly open, but I don't see anything. Just darkness. My lungs feel weak and heavy, like they're coated in a thick layer of grime. And when I cough, a cloud of dust swirls around me, making me cough more until I'm about to hack up a lung. My head is throbbing, foggy and immobile. My arms are pinned to my sides. Where am I? As the dust settles, my coughing finally subsides, and I begin to remember. New Mexico. Dulce. Wait, did all that really happen? I want to believe it was all just a dream, but by now I know enough to realize that there's no such thing as just a dream anyway. And this was no dream. I was the one who brought this place down. Without even knowing how I did it, I took the power that one had given me and brought a whole government base crashing down to its foundations. Next time I pull a stunt like that, I'll wait till I'm not in the place before I tear it apart. It made sense at the time. I guess I have some things to learn about having a legacy. Now everything around me is silent. I'll take that as a good sign. It means that nobody's trying to kill me anymore. Which means that they're either just as buried as I am, or they're dead. For now, I'm alone. One is dead. Malcolm and Sam are gone. They probably think I'm dead too. As for my family, they'd prefer it if I was dead. No one would even know if I gave up here, right now. And there's part of me that wants to. I've fought so hard. Isn't it enough that I came this far? It would be so easy just to stop struggling here, to stay buried, to stay forgotten. If one were still here, she would toss her hair impatiently and tell me to snap out of it, to get over myself. She'd tell me that I'm not even halfway finished with the job she left me with, and that there are bigger things to worry about than myself. She'd remind me that it's not just my life that hangs in the balance. But one isn't here anymore, and so it's up to me to tell myself those things. I'm alive. That in itself is amazing. I'd triggered the explosives in the armory with the full knowledge that it might be the last thing I did. I'd done it so Malcolm Good, the man who'd started to feel like some kind of dad to me, could escape with his real son, Sam. I figured that if they got away, at least I would have died doing one good thing. But I didn't die. For now, at least. And I figure that if I'm still alive despite everything, there has to be a reason for it. There's still something I need to do. So I try to slow my racing heart, breathe steadily, and assess the situation. I'm buried, yes. But there's air here, and I can move my head, my shoulders, even my arms a little. Good. My breathing stirs up more dust, and that shows me which way is up. And also, there's a little light seeping in from somewhere. And if there's any light at all, it means I can't be too far from the surface. There's no room for me to move my arms, but I struggle anyway, trying to push against the shattered stone and concrete I'm trapped under. It doesn't do any good, of course. I'm not a vat born with genetically enhanced strength or even a natural powerhouse like my adoptive brother, Ivan. I'm tall, but slight, and built like a regular human, with only moderately more physical ability. I'm not even sure if the most highly trained of the Vatborn would be able to dig his way out of here. There's no way I have any shot at all. But then One's face enters my mind again. Her wry, affectionate eye roll. The way she would look at me, Like, really? That's all you've got? And something occurs to me. It's not all I've got. Not anymore. I may not have strength, but I do have power. I focus on the rocks around me, knowing that with my legacy, the legacy that one gave me, I can shake all this debris clear. I close my eyes and focus on it, picturing the rubble shaking and splitting, moving away from me until I'm free. Nothing happens. It doesn't budge. Move, damn it, I think. And then I realize that I've actually said the words aloud without meaning to. Either way, the rocks don't pay any attention. Suddenly I'm angry. First I'm angry at myself for being so stupid, for being so weak, for not having mastered the gift that one gave me, for getting myself to this place at all. But it isn't my fault. I was only trying to do what was right. It's not myself I should be angry at. It's my people, the Mogadorians who got me here. The Mogadorians who worship brute force and believe that war is a way of life. Soon I can feel my rage coursing through my body. Nothing in my life has ever been fair. I never had a shot at all. I think about Ivan, who was a best friend to me. We grew up together, and then he betrayed me. He tried to kill me, more than once. I think about my father, who didn't think twice about letting the Mogadorian scientists experiment on me with machines that had been completely untested and came close to frying my brain. It was nothing to him to risk sacrificing me for the cause. And what cause was that? The cause of creating more destruction, of killing more people and gaining more power for himself. But power over what? When we conquered Lorien, we'd left it a lifeless, destroyed husk of a planet. There was nothing left on Lorien to rule. Was that what we were going to do to Earth, too? For people like my father, that's not the point. The point is war. The point is winning. To him, I was just another potential weapon to be used and discarded. That's all anyone's ever been worth to him. The more I think about it, the more I feel my mind racing with rage. I hate him. I hate Ivan. I hate Satrakis Ra and the Good Book for teaching them all that this is the right way to live. I hate them all. My fingers and toes start to tingle. I feel the rocks around me start to tremble. I'm doing it. My legacy is working. You can let your anger destroy you, or you can use it for something. I close my eyes again, clench my fists, and scream as loud as I can, letting all my fury out in one big burst. And with a massive whoosh, the dirt and stone and rubble begin to crumble. My body is shaking all over, and the ground is shaking too. Before long, it's all slid away, and I'm free again. It's as if a giant shovel has scooped me out. But someone else isn't as lucky. Not 10 feet away from me, a Mogadorian soldier is wedged beneath what looks like part of a shattered steel doorframe. He groans and stirs now that the weight's been lifted. He's alive as I am. Awesome. Chapter 2. I pull myself to my feet, staggering a bit. My whole body aches like I've just been squeezed in a giant vise, but I don't think anything's broken. I'm covered in dirt and dust and sweat, and, yes, some blood, but not a lot of that either. Somehow, I've managed to avoid any serious injury. I don't know how, and I don't really care. The other Mogadorian isn't so lucky. As I stand, he lets out a low groan, but he doesn't look up at me or move. He's so beaten up that he barely seems to realize he's not buried anymore. I don't even think he realizes I'm here. He must have gotten hit pretty hard, because this guy doesn't look like the type who would be easy to take out. He's as big as Ivan, and built like a pro linebacker, with a thick neck and bulging muscles. But I can tell even from here that he's not Vatborn. His facial features are too clean-lined, and too even to be one of the genetically altered warriors who make up the majority of the Mogadorian's army. This one is a trueborn, like me, like my father. From the tattoo on his skull, I can tell that he's an officer, not a grunt. It figures. The Vatborn are bred to be cannon fodder, while the trueborn give the orders. Maybe that's why I don't remember seeing him while I was holding back the troops. Unlike Ivan, who charged after me and got himself killed as a result, this guy must have been leading from the rear. I actually feel a stab of disgust at the thought. A good commander leads by example, not by cowering behind his men. Not that it did him much good. Anyway, none of it matters much. I need to figure out what I'm going to do with him. First things first, I check him over for any weapons. He grunts a little as I pat him down, and his eyes flutter for a moment, but he doesn't resist my search. Not that I find anything useful on him. If he had a blaster, it's long gone, and he doesn't seem to have a knife on him either. I don't find so much as a breath mint in his pockets, which, from the foul stench of the air emitting from his mouth in wheezing bursts, would probably do him more good than a weapon right about now. The one thing that I can't help but notice is the blood. This guy's practically covered in it. It's seeping out from under the dust and dirt that coat his pale skin, and staining through the torn-up clothes he still has on. I don't see any one big injury, but he's a mess for sure. When I'm satisfied that he's not going to jump to his feet and take me down the moment I turn my back on him, I look around the area I'm standing in and try to get my bearings. The bulk of Dulce Base was built underground to keep it away from prying eyes, but I guess my little stunt changed all that. I'm standing in a giant crater, at least 100 feet across at the top, and there's a clear blue sky above. The only problem is, I'm at least 20 feet down from where rock ends and sky begins. The wreckage is everywhere. Rocks and cement and toppled columns, busted computers and equipment with their exposed electrical wires sparking dangerously. When I smell the familiar stench of gasoline, I realize that I'm basically standing in the middle of a huge powder keg. This place could go up in flames at any second. It's sort of a miracle there haven't been any more explosions yet. I have to get out of here quick. Luckily, despite the fact that we're so far down, there's so much debris piled high in every direction that I figure it won't be too hard to climb my way to the surface. I figure out which direction will be the easiest to negotiate and start to head that way. And then stop. I look behind me at the guy lying there on the ground, the Mogadorian who still hasn't stirred beyond a groan. I could leave him here to die alone. I have myself to worry about, and besides, one more dead Mogadorian is a good thing. But something stops me. It's not that I'm just being nice. It's way too late to start having moral qualms now. After all, I've killed more than my share of Mog since all this started. For a moment, I wonder if my dad ever would have guessed that I had it in me. I wonder if it would give him even a tiny bit of pride if he knew. Of course, my dad's pride is the last thing I'm looking for now. That's not why I decide to turn back, though. Instead, it's because I know that a single unarmed Mogadorian officer can do me more good alive than he can dead. For one thing, if he was stationed here, he'll know his way around the surrounding area and any nearby towns. Deep in the middle of the desert, without even a compass to guide me, that stuff matters if I want to get out alive. So I head back to the guy, grab him under the arms, and start hauling him along. This guy's really heavy, and it's all I can do to drag him over the craggy piles of junk and rocks as we make our way across the vast expanse of the base's ruins toward the edge of the crater. The sun is higher in the sky now, and we're completely exposed to it. I feel a bead of sweat forming at my brow and making its way down my face, and then, before I know it, I'm completely drenched. I try to clear a path as I move, kicking aside dusty monitors and crushed aluminum piping and whatever else is blocking the way. Not that it does much good. Within minutes, my arms feel like noodles, my legs hurt, and my back is killing me. We're not even halfway to where we need to be. This isn't going to work. Finally, when I drop the Mogadorian to the ground to catch my breath, he stirs. "Hey," I say. "Can you hear me?" He replies. "Well, it's not that helpful, but it's better than nothing, I figure." "Hey, listen," I try again. "We've got to get out of here. Can you walk?" He peers up at me, his heavy brow furrowed, and I can guess why. He's trying to figure out who I am and what I'm doing here. I'm covered in grime, so he probably can't tell that I don't have the skull tattoo that denotes Mogadorian rank. And he looks up at me in confusion. I don't have time for him to be confused, or time for him to come to his senses, assuming he ever will. We have to get out of here now. I have no idea whether there are any others still alive elsewhere on the base, or if reinforcements are on the way. Plus, I'm half expecting the whole place to go up in flames at any second. That's if I don't die of thirst before it happened. I try a different tack. I speak to him in our native Mogadorian tongue, the language that's mostly only ever used now for ceremonial purposes. I quote the good book. "Strength is sacred," I say. It's one of the most important tenets in Mogadorian society. His eyes come into focus. "On your feet, soldier," I snap. I'm only half surprised when it does the trick, and he slowly levers himself up onto one knee and raises himself to his feet. Typical Mogadorian. There's nothing my people respond to more enthusiastically than empty authority. He's swaying a bit as he comes to a standing position. His left arm is hanging funny, and he's pale, sweat popping out across his forehead and along his upper lip. But he's up, for now. "Let's go," I tell him, pointing towards the opening high above. "March!" Without a word, he lumbers past me. I follow him, realizing that I'm not in much better shape than he is. As we scramble over the heaps of rubble, I find myself thinking of Sam and Malcolm. I hope they made it out of here okay. My cell phone got crushed when I brought down the base, so I can't call Malcolm to find out what happened, arrange somewhere to meet up, or even ask for help. All I can do is have some hope. It feels like hours before we finally come to the edge of the blown-out base, though the sun is still high in the sky, so it can't have been that long. So far, none of my fears has come to pass. There have been no explosions or fires, and no sign of Mogadorians coming back to dig through the wreckage. The pit is deeper than it appeared earlier, and I look up and see exactly how far we have to climb to get out of here. Luckily, there's enough junk piled up around the edge that we'll be able to find a path to the top. But it won't be easy. Is anything ever easy? I'm soaked in sweat, though, and practically panting for air as we pull ourselves up the side of the cliff, using toppled girders and jutting pieces of cement and whatever we can find to use as handholds. My new best friend is pushing through the pain, his black eyes glassy and unfocused. But he's doing it. I'm embarrassed to see that even in this state, he's still at least as strong as I am. I'm guessing he took a blow to the head from the explosion. The good news is, it's made him nice and docile. When I tell him to do something, he does it. The bad news is, he has no idea what he's doing. I need him alive, so I've got to keep a close eye on him every second in case he does something stupid. "What's your name?" I ask him once I've got my breath back. Might as well know who I'm dealing with. "Rexicus Saturnus," he answers after a minute. The name sounds vaguely familiar. He doesn't look that much older than me, and I wonder if I'd ever seen him when I lived at home with my parents and sister. Ashwood is the largest Mogadorian community on Earth, after all, so there's a good chance he grew up there too. Even if he was a bit older than me, I'd have seen him around occasionally or heard his name. I study his face, though, and find that I don't recognize him at all. "They call me Rex." I just nod. There's nothing to say right now. We just have to keep climbing. So we climb. And then, after who knows how much time, we emerge from the pit and stumble over the edge into a vast desert. I didn't think it would be possible, but the sun on my brow feels even hotter than before. I only take a few seconds to rest and catch my breath before I dust myself off and scan the horizon, looking for something, anything, other than dirt and rocks. And after a minute, my eyes settle on what looks like a small building. I don't know what we'll find. There could still be Mogadorians inside, for all I know, but I decide I don't have much choice, especially if it means finding water and some respite from the heat. "All right then, Rex," I say, pointing to the building in the distance. "Let's get moving. That way." He just nods and starts walking. I follow him, wondering again if I'm doing the right thing. It would be so easy to kill him. For now he's weak. His reflexes dulled, his mind fuzzy. It would take nothing for me to sneak up behind him and get rid of him once and for all. This could be my only chance. Once he's recovered, he'd be able to overpower me easily. Then he might not think twice before killing me. But he's a Mogadorian officer. I have no idea what information he has or how valuable he is to my people. All I know is that if he knows anything that can help Malcolm and the Lorik people, it's worth it to keep him alive, even if it means risking my own neck. It's what one would want. Chapter 3. My feet feel like they're made of lead. It's a supreme effort to lift each one and set it back down. My head is throbbing. My tongue feels swollen, and my nose is so dry it hurts to breathe in through it. But my throat is coated with sand, and swallowing makes me want to retch. My skin is tight and crinkly, and I itch everywhere. When I glance at my arm, I realize it's bright red, the harsh sunlight already burning me. Every movement sends little jolts of pain washing across my every joint, over every inch of exposed flesh. I can't see straight. The desert stretches out ahead of me, and the building we're heading towards doesn't seem to be getting closer. In fact, part of me is starting to wonder if it's even real. When I stare at it for too long, it begins to waver, like it's just a mirage that will always remain a few thousand paces in the distance. I'm not sure, though. I'm not sure of anything anymore. I've never felt more alone in my life. In the past, even when things were at their worst, I always had one urging me along, reminding me of what was right. Then one was gone, but at least I had Malcolm. Now he's gone too, and I only have myself. I just wish myself was someone I had more faith in. Of course, I'm not actually alone. Rex is here too. But Rex is not my friend. If he knew who or what I was, he'd probably kill me on the spot. Killing the traitor Mogadorian who turned on his father and brought down the Dolce base would earn him at least one promotion in rank. At the moment, though, Rex is useless. His strides become more erratic. His head is down like he can just bowl through the entire New Mexico desert, and he keeps muttering to himself. I don't know what he's saying, but I get the impression he's talking to somebody else. Somebody who obviously isn't here right now. So it's just me, the desert, and a hallucinating Mog soldier. And then the building we're heading towards begins to transform from just a thick smudge in the distance, where sand meets sky, into a real shape that I can recognize. It's getting bigger, closer. We're almost there. And it dawns on me exactly what it is. With everything that's happened, I'd practically forgotten. Miles out from the main base, along the perimeter, there was a watchtower. Was. When Malcolm and I first got here, it had been the first thing we spotted, along with a generator right behind it that was powering the base's electric fence. I decided to bring it toppling down, sending it crashing into the generator in order to sneak in and rescue Sam. I thought I'd destroy the tower completely, but now, as we approach it, I begin to see that the actual guard station at the top survived. A metal and concrete room that's now lying on its side 100 feet from the ruined generator. It's not much, barely bigger than a bathroom, really, but we can hole up there for a while. We're almost there when I hear the most wonderful sound in the world. I try not to run. At this point, if I fall down, I doubt I'd be able to get back up again. But I hurry towards the noise. And there, jutting up within the tower's twisted, bare foundation, is a jagged, broken pipe. Bubbling up from it is water. I drop to my knees, right next to the fallen tower where the spouting water has formed a little pool around the pipe. I would jump in if I could. I'd let it soak in through every pore. Since I can't do that, I scoop up as much water as I can into my cupped palms and splash it on my face. Then, I take another scoop, raise it to my lips, and drink. The water is warm and metallic, but tastes like life itself. I feel immediately better. I'm filled with a burst of energy spreading through my body, from my chest all the way to my toes and fingertips. I take another greedy sip. I can think clearly again. Then I remember Rex. He's on his knees beside me, staring at the pool with bloodshot eyes. But he's not drinking. It's like he doesn't remember how. I reach down and splash some water on his face. His eyes widen. He licks his lips, and then he's hunched over the pool, scooping handful after handful up to his mouth, lapping at it furiously. I pull away and just sit back on my haunches, taking it all in. We've got water now and shelter. Maybe there are even some rations in there, if we're lucky. We might just survive this yet. Or will we? As I've started to feel like things are going to be okay, I hear a low, threatening rumble. A growl. I turn my head, startled by the noise, and come face to face with a huge, powerfully built beast. It's a wolf. The largest I've ever seen. His golden eyes are narrowed menacingly. His tail is twitching, and his ears are pricked for a fight. He bares his fangs. Chapter 4 "Easy there, big guy," I say carefully, clambering up as gracefully as I can manage, hoping not to spook the animal any more than I already have. "We're not here to hurt you." He digs his paws into the ground and hunches forward. If he decides to pounce, we're done for. But if I can call up One's legacy again, I might be able to shake things up enough to knock the wolf off his feet, giving me time to run for the protection of the guard station. It's not the best plan ever, but it's the only one I've got. The water's refreshed me a bit, but my head's still throbbing. I'm swaying on my feet, and my skin's burning. Not the ideal circumstances to try to use the legacy I don't have a complete handle on yet. But I concentrate as hard as I can and clench my hand into a fist. I raise it slowly and point it at the ground. It was a soft rumble, and the earth below us stirs like a table that's been bumped by accident. It's something, but it's not going to help much. I'm surprised at how the wolf reacts. He gives a small yelp and backs away a step, eyeing me now with curiosity rather than anger. He tilts his head to one side like he's trying to figure me out, and then slowly begins padding toward me. This time, he doesn't growl. He almost looks friendly. Whatever I was expecting when I tried to nail him with my legacy, this wasn't it. Hey there, I say, trying to modulate my voice so that it's soft and non-threatening, holding out my upturned palms. No sudden movements. He's right in front of me now. Studying me. Sniffing me. A low whine is coming from his throat. I didn't have a dog or any pets growing up. My father, the great general, didn't see any value in pets that couldn't do something useful. So I have no idea how to read this animal and no idea whether or not I should be running right now. When he licks the palm of my left hand, though, I'm pretty sure it's not the prelude to an attack. Good boy. I reach out and ever so slowly pet him on the head. His fur is thick and soft, and he gazes at me steadily. I have no idea why, but he suddenly seems to trust me. I turn to see what Rex thinks of all this, and discover that he hasn't been watching any of it. He's passed out. For a second, I worry that he's dead, but then I see that he's breathing, but barely. His injuries, in addition to the exertion and dehydration, must have caught up with him. I need to get him out of the open desert. The sun's starting to sink toward the horizon. I've heard it gets cold in the desert at night. The temperature is already starting to drop. If nothing else, it would be nice to have four walls protecting us from the elements. "You gonna stick around?" I ask the wolf as I lift Rex up by his armpits and begin to drag him toward the guard station. I feel stupid talking to an animal, but it's not like I have any better options for conversation. He looks me up and down, and then begins to follow me, silently loping along. Luckily, it only takes us a few minutes to reach the structure. All the windows have shattered from when it collapsed, but there are wooden shutters that look intact. After a couple of hard shoves, the door swings open. The place is on its side, but it looks mostly intact. The inside's got a few desks, some chairs, clothes, lockers, filing cabinets, a smashed computer, and a busted-up mini-fridge. Yeah, this should do nicely. I step inside, dragging Rex with me, and the wolf follows behind us. I'm not sure why, but I feel strangely reassured to have him with us. Unfortunately, the place is pretty tiny. After I drop Rex's body to the ground, there's barely space to turn around without tripping over the wolf. I'm thinking maybe there isn't room for all of us in here. He studies me for a second, as if he knows exactly what I'm thinking. He lets out a bark, and then he starts to change. First, the edges of his body lose focus, and then his fur begins to glow, somehow smoothing itself out into a glossy shell around his body, almost like armor. He turns from white to green. I take a shaky step back. I wonder if this is what happens when you spend a whole day wandering around a desert dragging a guy almost twice your size. I open my mouth to speak, and then realize I have no idea what to say. He's not done yet either. Now his skin is rough and scaly, and then his whole body begins to ripple like water in a pond just after you've tossed a rock into it. He's shrinking. It's all happening so fast that I barely have time to wonder what's going on. But then it's over. Sitting at my feet, blinking up with huge glittering eyes, is a lizard. Holy shit, I mutter. They're suddenly the only words I can remember. It's not like my life has been boring. I was raised in a secret community of alien conquerors, had my mind grafted onto the mind of a dead girl, recently developed superpowers. But none of those things has been weirder than watching a wolf transform into a lizard right before my eyes. Chapter 5. I know who you are. It's the first time Rex has spoken to me directly. We've been here a few days now. I decided to stick it out to let both of us recover. Although, I'm barely sleeping because I worry that every little noise I hear could be the Mogs, or the U.S. military, coming to see if anyone survived the explosion. Oddly enough, I haven't seen a hint of anyone, Mog or human. They must assume that everyone is dead, and there's no urgent need to sift through the debris. We've got shelter and water. And although we went through the meager rations in the guard tower pretty quickly, I've managed to find small stores of food scattered around the ruins of the Dolce base. Military rations and crackers and chips and dried fruit. We're not exactly living large, but it could be worse. I was able to patch myself up pretty quickly using the first aid kit mounted to the wall of our hideout. And with rest and hydration, Rex is getting better too. His colors improved each day, along with his breathing, although his arm still looks like it might be broken. For the past few days, he's been drifting in and out of consciousness, sometimes sleeping fitfully, other times passed out cold. Yesterday, he spent most of the day awake, but he just sat in the corner, staring at the ceiling, totally silent. It was hard to tell if he couldn't speak, or if he just didn't want to. But now, he's decided to talk. And the thing he says is the one thing I've been dreading. He recognizes me. I just shrug, trying to act like I don't know what he's talking about. Yeah? I ask noncommittal.
You're Artemus Sutek, he continues. Son of General Andrakas Sutek.
Now there's no mistaking the contempt in his voice, or the way his lip curls in disgust.
You're a traitor.
I freeze. He knows everything. I stare at him, trying to figure out what he's going to do next. I can still take him out if I have to. I won't have that chance once he's back to full health. I shake the idea off one more time. I might be making a huge mistake, but I still think he's too valuable to kill. It's a risk I'm willing to take.
I saved your life, I say evenly.
Rex snorts.
You betrayed our people. You blew up the research lab at Ashwood.
That's not strictly true. I shattered the lab, yes, with the legacy that one gave me, but I let it pass as he raises his voice.
And I'm willing to bet that you're responsible for all this, too. Aren't you?
I turn away. I can't even look at him. Even though I know I was doing the right thing, the thing I had to do,
there's still a part of me that feels ashamed. Now he's almost yelling, although he's still too weak and hoarse to summon the strength to really scream. You're pathetic. I don't know how a weakling like you managed to do it alone, but you're the one who blew up the base. You killed everyone. Your own people. What I don't tell him is that I wasn't on my own. From the pieces of the puzzle that I've managed to put together, the chaos and noise during the attack, the extent of the wreckage afterwards, I'm pretty sure I wasn't the only one attacking the base when it collapsed. If he wants to think I did all of this myself, that's fine. But I know that the guard must have been there too. I just shrug. I was looking for somebody, I tell him. You guys were holding him here. I took him back. Rex is still glaring at me. You killed all those soldiers to save one person? He asks. That human we were holding, the boy? Why? My new friend saves me the trouble of answering. He's been out and about all day, scouting as usual, and now he swoops in through the open doorway of our shelter and settles on my shoulder. He's taken on the shape of a hawk today, and his talons grip tight through the t-shirt I scavenged from a locker. Rex coils when he sees the bird. What the hell is that? It's dust, I say, happy for the change in conversation. Rex just narrows his eyes at me. I can see the wheels turning in his head. I can't figure out what he's thinking, but whatever it is, it's nothing good. I reach up and stroke Dust's head, and he ruffles his feathers contentedly. He and I have already become buddies. The name Dust seemed appropriate out here in the middle of the desert, and he seems perfectly happy to be called anything at all. I don't know what he is or why he's out here, but I'm starting to have a feeling we've both been lonely for a pretty long time. Rex, on the other hand, doesn't seem at all pleased to have company. He eyes me and Dust for a moment longer, and then, out of nowhere, springs to his feet. Before I know what's happening, he's got me pinned up against the wall, his fingers wrapped around my neck. Dust flutters from my shoulder and alights on the table across the room. He lets out an ear-splitting squawk, but Rex ignores it. I don't know what you're up to, traitor, he snarls at me. And I don't know what that thing is. But your days are numbered. Look at how weak you are. Even injured, I could kill you right now. Then do it, I say. I'm bluffing, of course. Kill me, I tell him. Then there's a roar from behind him, and Rex spins around to come face to face with Dust. Only now he's not a hawk, or a lizard, or a wolf. He's shifted into a huge lion, so big the shack can hardly contain him. Having successfully gotten Rex's attention with the growl, he now opens his huge jaws and licks his chops as if to say, "Go ahead, try me." Rex jumps back, startled, but he isn't as surprised as I thought he would be. He pivots his head towards me with a nasty frown. "I knew it," he said. "Only a turncoat like you would keep a chimera for a pet." I look at him blankly. Chimera? It rings a bell, but I have no idea what it means. Rex snorts. You don't even know what he is, do you? That's what it is. It's a Loric beast, a shape changer. High Command thought they were just legends, but when we invaded Lorien, it turned out they were real, nasty things, and vicious. Of course. Chimera. Now I remember the word. They're mentioned in the Good Book. Something about evil little pests, I think. But the days I used to spend poring over Satrakis Ra's sacred book of directives feel so long ago that I can barely remember any of it. Then I remember something else. I've seen these creatures before, in one's memories of escaping Lorien. But I thought they were all dead now, that they've been exterminated by my people along with the rest of her planet. The thought that I'm wrong makes me smile. The guards still have a few tricks up their sleeves. And Rex isn't as tough as he wants me to think. I've been shocked he'd had the strength to attack me at all. But it must have taken all he had out of him, because now he sinks back to the floor. Dust is still watching him warily, ready to pounce if necessary. But I wave him off, and just like that, he's back to his bird form. I should be getting used to it, but I'm not. It amazes me every time he transforms. And now that I know what he really is, it gives me a glimmer of hope, too. What's he doing here, though? I ask, more to myself than to Rex. A smirk flashes across his face. He knows something. Then, I get it. You were holding him prisoner, weren't you? Like Sam. Like Malcolm. Rex looks up at me with fire in his eyes. You just don't get it, do you? He says. We're at war. It's not a contest to see who can be the nicest. Prisoners get taken, people die. My friends have died. They should have been your friends, too, if you hadn't decided to betray them. I almost let his words sting me, but then I push them aside. You're wrong, I say. I do get it. Prisoners get taken. Come to think of it, it looks like I've taken a prisoner myself. You. Chapter 6. I'm more worried than I let on. A few days after my confrontation with Rex, he's healthier than ever. I've got dust for protection. I know by now he won't let anything happen to me, but if it weren't for him, Rex would be able to overpower me easily. I'm starting to realize how lucky I've been so far, and what a mistake it could have been for me to keep Rex alive. It's not just that. I'm getting antsier than ever about the Mogadorians showing up again and finding us. I have frisked Rex at least 10 times by now, looking for communications devices and weapons, but I'm still worried he could have some way of getting in touch with them, of bringing them back for us. We need to get out of here. We need a plan. Every day I go out scavenging the base for food, and every day I'm coming back with less and less of it. It's time to move on. But to where? I have no clue. I wish I had a way of getting in touch with Malcolm. Assuming he made it out of here alive, he'd know what to do. But all the equipment in the base is damaged beyond repair, and I haven't been able to dig up so much as a cell phone. Until I'm back in civilization, I'm on my own. I try to think about what one would say if she were here. I'm so used to having her kicking around in my head that if I try hard, I can summon her image as if we still shared a mind. When I close my eyes and picture her face, I see us back in California, standing on the beach. She's barefoot in the surf, her arms crossed against her chest, her hair pinkish in the sunset and curling in the breeze. Rex is better. His bruises have faded and the cuts and abrasions crisscrossing his body seem to be knitting back together. The big gash on his side that was squirting all that blood when I first found him will take time to heal properly, but it's really only a surface wound. As for his arm, it wasn't broken after all, just a dislocated shoulder that he managed to pop back into place with a casual grimace when he put his mind to it. His mood, though, is as bad as mine, maybe worse. He spends most of his time sitting in the corner with a dark look on his face, sometimes muttering under his breath to himself, and other times scowling silently for hours on end. If I didn't know better, I'd say he was depressed. But that's impossible. Real Mogadorians don't get depressed. They get even. Strangely, the only thing that seems to snap Rex out of it is dust. They've reached a tentative truce with each other, and despite his attempts to appear unimpressed, Rex seems just as fascinated by the Chimera's transformations as I am. One day, when Dust is in a playful mood and flitting from one shape to another, from rabbit to parrot to chimpanzee to Labrador, I even see Rex watching him with something approaching a smile. It gives me an idea. How much do you know about him? I ask, nodding toward the Chimera. I'm not really expecting anything, so I'm taken aback when Rex actually answers me. Not a lot, he says. I don't know where they found him or how long he was at Dulce. I just know that we've been running experiments on them. Experiments? I give an involuntary shudder at the word, imagining Dust in some underground lab while a Mogadorian scientist tortures him in the name of Satrakis Ra. I know all too well what that's like. I was one of those lab rats myself once. I don't want to think about it, but I can't help thinking about it. And something clicks in my mind. Something about what Rex said that strikes me as odd. I just can't quite place what it is. Them? I ask. Huh? Rex says quizzically. He tries to play off the mistake, but the guilty flicker in his eyes lets me know I'm onto something. You said they've been doing experiments on them. As in, more than one. Are there more Chimera out there? Somewhere on Earth? His eyes shift to the ceiling. He shrugs. I thought all the Chimera were killed on Lorien, I muse, circling the question carefully, trying not to remind him that he's supposed to be giving me the silent treatment. He remembers. He doesn't take my bait. The next day, though, when I find him in his usual spot in the corner again, his chin resting on his fist, I give it one more try. There's more of them out there, aren't there? I ask. Dust isn't the last Chimera. Rex glares at me. His eyes are dead and distant, black holes. Dust is a cat now, snoozing under the table. Listen, I say. He doesn't even look at me. Dust would kill you if I wanted him to. You know that, right? You're still weak, and even if you weren't, he's more powerful than both of us put together. So, have him kill me, Rex says dully, still not meeting my gaze. It almost sounds like he means it. I can't hide my surprise. I can't believe a trueborn would say that, I say. The shock in my voice is genuine. Rex's head snaps up, and he looks me right in the eye, his brow furrowed in some combination of anger and shame. It was the right thing for me to say. I push it further. To stop fighting, that would make you even more of a weakling than I am. I'll never stop fighting, he snaps. I'll see the Lorik dead if it's the last thing I do. But killing you, Adamus Sutek, that's going to be the first thing I take care of. Fine, I say. Kill me. He knows he can't. Not yet, at least. Because I have dust. I know my days are numbered anyway, I tell Rex. You'll kill me eventually, or my father will, or some vat-born who doesn't even know my name. But right now, I'm the one with the power. You try to leave, and that cute little guy napping under the table will turn into a 10-ton gorilla and peel you like a banana. Rex rolls his eyes, angrily hocks a giant wad of saliva onto the cement floor, and goes back to staring at the ceiling. He knows I'm right. I push on, knowing that I'm making progress. I need you too, Rex. There's a reason you're alive. It's because I can use you. You have information, and information is what I want. I don't know anything, he spits out. Tell me what I want to know, I say, and we'll get out of here. There will be plenty of time for you to kill me once we've made it out of this wasteland. I won't even stop you. I can see him considering it. I hold my breath. If this doesn't work, I really will kill him, I decide. When I can see he's at his most vulnerable, I lean on him with one last question. They. You said they. Where are the rest of the Chimera? I haven't seen them, he mutters. But there are a bunch of them. At least 10, maybe more. They came on a separate ship from the guard. At least, that's what I overheard some of the other officers saying. Suddenly it all feels incredibly important. You said they were experimenting on them, I say, trying to keep the sense of urgency from creeping into my voice. What kind of experiments? I guess Rex doesn't see the point in clamming up now that he's said this much already, because this time he answers my question without hesitation. He sounds almost proud as he explains it. They're trying to figure out how Chimera's transformations work. Satrakis Ra thinks that if we can isolate the gene that gives them their abilities, we can duplicate the process with the Vatborn. The way he says we chills me. I've forgotten what it was like to live among them, to believe that your own self-worth is bound up in the messed-up glory of a warlord who chased 9 teenagers across a solar system just to make sure they were all good and dead. Where are they? I ask. Tell me where they are, and we'll go there together. He looks shocked at my intensity, but he takes a deep breath. They're not here. Dust got separated from the rest of them, somehow, and they were keeping him here until someone could take him back to the main facility. Tell me where, Rex? Only now does it seem to dawn on him exactly how much he said and what the consequences of that could be. Revealing the secret goes against all of his training, against everything in the good book. His voice wavers a little, but he tells me anyway. New York, he says. A place called Plum Island, Chapter 7
Nice city, Rex remarks, his tone heavy with sarcasm as we set eyes on the town. This was all totally worth it. It's been a long day for all of us. After trying and failing to find a working vehicle anywhere on the grounds of the base, we'd had no other choice but to cajole Dust into carrying us, on his back, as a donkey. He'd brayed and stomped his feet as first Rex and then I had climbed on top of him. But he'd done it, and after hours of trudging we were finally here. As civilization goes, the town we finally stumbled upon is a step up from the ruins of Dulce Base, but only barely. It's dusty and run down, and half the storefronts on Main Street are boarded up. The other half are just weird, junk shops and drug stores that look like they haven't changed their window displays in about 30 years. Still, there are paved roads, cars, and working streetlights, not to mention hot food. When we make it to the center of town, I can't help stopping outside Celia's Cafe and peering in the window to stare at people sitting in booths, looking happy as they chow down on hamburgers and pancakes and eggs and bacon. I can practically feel my mouth watering. After living on whatever canned and boxed and wrapped food we could scrounge up from the guard station's lockers and the base's remains, the thought of a real, proper meal is enough to make me drool. Rex reaches for the door of the restaurant, but I grab him by the shoulder. Later. He makes a sour face, but drops the door handle. He knows as well as I do that we don't have any money to pay for a meal. Food can wait. The first thing we need is cash. I'm still standing on the sidewalk, wondering how feasible it would be to rob a bank, when a stout, middle-aged couple exits the diner and brushes past me. They continue on down the street, and I watch as a skinny young guy carrying a tattered gray backpack bumps into the husband and swipes his wallet. It happens so fast that I almost can't believe what I saw. For a second, I consider running after the pickpocket, taking the wallet away from him and returning it to the couple. But Rex has a different idea. "We need money, right?" he asks, his eyes following the pickpocket, who's now strolling down the street, the very picture of nonchalance. "Follow him, but not too close. We don't want him seeing us." I don't know what he's thinking, but I nod, and together we start after the pickpocket. Whatever he has in mind, I hope it works. The criminal works hard. I'll give him that. From what I can see, he swipes 3 more wallets and 2 purses over the course of the next hour, stuffing everything into his bag without pausing for a second. Somehow, he never doubles back, never walks the same street twice. At one point, I spot a cop car, but the thief spots it too, and lays low until he's well out of sight. This guy's obviously a pro. After the cops are gone and the guy's just swiped his 2nd purse, Rex nudges me. "Get ready." He crosses the street, picks up the pace to get a block ahead of our prey, and then cuts back over and starts heading towards me. There's an alley up ahead, and Rex times it perfectly. He's just passing the pickpocket on the outside when they both reach the alley, and with a quick shove, he sends the smaller guy tumbling sideways, right into the alley, and temporarily out of sight, or at least as close as we can manage. I hurry to catch up. The thief doesn't waste any time complaining or asking what we want, or anything like that. Instead, he bolts for the alley's far side as I follow them both into the narrow brick corridor that dead ends against a brick wall with 1 lonely dumpster. I can already see his plan. He's going to spring up its side, launching himself partway up the wall, and then grab the top and lever himself over, leaving us in the dust. Frustrated, I pick up my pace, as does Rex, but it's obvious we're not going to catch up to the pickpocket before he hits that dumpster. I stop short. We don't have much time, and I can think of only 1 other way to stop this guy in his tracks. I channel my angry emotions, raise my hand, and focus on the ground below that dumpster. "Come on," I mutter, gritting my teeth. And just as the thief makes that first jump, I feel a small tremor in the ground. The dumpster comes flying towards us. It slams into the pickpocket, hurling him against the alley's side wall. He hits it hard enough that we hear the air escape his lungs as he collapses in a heap on the ground.
"What was that?"
Rex says as he runs back. Looked to me like he was planning to go up and over, I reply as I crouch down next to him. He's still breathing, which is good. There's a big difference between killing Mogs who are attacking you and killing some idiot who steals people's wallets for a living. The impact just knocked him out. I glance over at the dumpster. Guess he didn't realize the dumpster was on wheels. I rifle through his backpack, finding all of his stolen goods and passing them back to Rex one by one. Grab the cash, leave the rest. A minute later, we've dropped the empty bags back in the guy's lap and are on our way. We've now got about $1,300 between us. Not too shabby. First things first, I tell Rex as we exit the alley. Supplies, a decent meal, and then we'll figure out how to get to Plum Island from here. Rex nods. Supplies, food, transportation, check. It's a little weird to find ourselves suddenly working together so easily. I could almost forget that we're supposed to be enemies. And while I'm glad that Rex isn't attacking me or trying to get in touch with Mog Base Command, I remind myself not to get too comfortable. It's nice to finally have someone to talk to, but I can't let myself think he's my friend. Still, it won't hurt to get some food together, right? We turn back towards the center of town, but as we're looping around, I'm distracted for a second by what looks like the shadow of a figure running past us. I jump a little, and Rex gives me a funny look. I must just be tired and hungry. When I scan up and down the sidewalk, there's no one at all in sight. All the way back to the restaurant, though, I can't quite shake the fear that we're being followed. And I don't mean by Dust, who's currently circling overhead as a hawk. In a booth at the diner, even the taste of French fries and a milkshake doesn't help me shake the feeling that I'm being watched. And that can only mean one thing. Mogadorians.